Hello, Market Watcher. I'm David Ravel, and this is the week just passed, USA. Turns out the return to normal may not be so great for Amazon. And then it's our look back at the trading, earnings, and economic reports, which made up the week of July 26 to 30 in the American markets. Well, it was a fascinating week for markets in the USA and a very difficult week for analysts. Nearly everything they had predicted went the other way this week. In particular, there was a stunning disclosure by Amazon, the major online retailer, and they revealed that this move back to an open economy may not be so good. You know, the times when people are free again to get up and actually go out and shop in person. Well, opening up may not be such a great idea for Amazon. You see, when people are forced to quarantine at home, Amazon became their principal place for shopping. But management at Amazon now projects that a return to in-person shopping may actually cut into Amazon's future profits. Needless to say, Wall Street took this surprise hard. Amazon closed down over 7% on the day and accounted for most of the decline in the NASDAQ on Friday. Now, in economic news for this past week, again, a tough week for Wall Street analysts who take pride in the accuracy of their estimates. We started out on Monday with durable goods orders down big from the month before, and less than half of what analysts had expected. Durable goods orders are always a good indication of overall business outlook. Weak durable goods orders does not bode well for this fall. Then for the really big miss on the week, on Thursday came the preliminary reading on the second quarter gross domestic product, the sum total of the nation's overall economy. This is the big enchilada, the one number that every Wall Street firm wants to get right, because it's the top line, the big picture of American commerce and finance. Get this wrong, and the likelihood is that all the rest of your numbers are off. It's time to go back and revise everything. And that's just what happened when GDP came in at a tepid 6.5% growth rate. Now, that's not bad normally, but right now, it indicates that our economic rebound is not nearly as robust as we thought. Back to the computer spreadsheets, boys. Finally, also on Thursday came word that once again those initial claims for unemployment were stuck at 400,000. Another sign that the recovery is not going as well as we all hoped. So overall, this weekend I suspect that there are many research departments that are working overtime to review and revise their current estimates. So let's take a step back and see just how this week unfolded. Here are our day-to-day market comments. It's a tradition in much of Europe, especially France and Spain, to take the month of August off. And I've noticed it increasingly. Wall Street is doing the same thing. That is, taking August off. That makes this week in July the most action-packed week of the year. Just look at the next 5 trading days. This week we'll get the first reading for the second quarter's gross domestic product, the total economy. This is a critical data point for analysts, as this is a fundamental starting point from which they will build their macro models of the economy, and hence how stocks should perform over the coming months. Now, last quarter it was reported that the economy grew a little better than 6%. The Street's expecting to have improvement in this area for the second quarter. They're looking at a better than 8% growth rate for Q2. We'll get to see on Thursday. Now, between now and then, the Federal Reserve's Open Market Committee meets, beginning at 2 p.m. tomorrow afternoon and concluding just 24 hours later with the Fed Chairman Jerome Powell's press conference. The FOMC will once again decide the fate of short-term interest rates. And although no big change is expected here, everyone presumes that the Fed will hold short-term rates at 0.25%. What is important is the release of the Fed's notes on where the economy is headed. And making this even more meaningful is the fact that the FOMC will not meet again for 2 long months. It's a long time between meetings, and will mean that the next meeting will be at the end of September, right in the middle of that critical time for the market, the always volatile fall season when most market corrections occur. Finally, we'll get the second quarter's earnings for all the market-leading companies this week, beginning today with Tesla, the current darling of Wall Street, and the major stock which has seen the most appreciation over the past 12 months. It seems that the street has not lost its appetite for electric cars and charismatic CEOs. Now, continuing the earnings report tomorrow will be Apple Computer, the world's most highly capitalized company, Microsoft, and Alphabet, the parent company of Google. After tomorrow, the street will have a pretty good idea of just how this second quarter earnings are going. On Wednesday, the social platform company Facebook reports, followed up on Thursday by online retailer Amazon. Collectively, these six companies, Tesla, Apple Computer, Microsoft, Alphabet, Google, Facebook, and Amazon, represent the heart and soul of this market. Traders and investors look to them to provide the momentum and leadership for any move higher in the bull market. Consequently, expectations are high for the group, and their performance will be scrutinized closely. In a quarter in which the economy is expected to have grown at 8%, the pressure will be on these six to provide a steady, if not spectacular, result. So honors today go to Tesla, as they'll lead off this incredible collection of stock market data. Tesla will hold their earnings conference call at 5:30 this afternoon East Coast time. You can listen to the call on Tesla's investor relations page. Well, as our financial advisor often says, our home is the largest investment we'll ever make. I think it took many of us on Wall Street some time to realize just how true that sentiment is. We tend to look at our home as just that, our dwelling place. We see its utilitarian value, but little else. It took a couple of economists to show us the investment side of real estate. Carl Case and Robert Schuller, both academics, devised the first measure of real estate as an asset class. Today, the Case-Shiller Index is the benchmark upon which Wall Street measures real property. Now, one of the benefits of this new way of measuring real estate has been to enable large funds like BlackRock to step in and invest in this asset class. You've no doubt read about BlackRock's staggering investments in homes across the country. I wouldn't be surprised to one day see BlackRock as the largest landlord in the nation. Now, in the 34 years since the Case-Shiller Index has been published, it has become apparent that real estate really is different. It's an asset class that marches to its own drummer. Certainly, the availability of cheap credit, most real estate is purchased with a mortgage, so the availability of low interest, readily available financing is a big boost to real estate, a condition we have in abundance right now. But easy credit is far from the only positive influence for real estate. High employment and demographics play a critical role. The most aggressive buyers of real estate are usually young families with good income. But in spite of these long-term trends, often being in real estate's favor, it sometimes goes in a different direction, entirely out of phase with all the other financial markets. Most recently was the case beginning in 2006, when the Case-Shiller Index started to head down. That's two full years before the great financial crisis of 08. And while the GFC came and went for the stock market, the real estate market continued to head down for four long years more, not hitting bottom until 2012, when then again real estate turned around and headed higher. And again, at least so far, it's unaffected by the current financial cross-currents. That is until recently, when suddenly real estate looks to have become soft. You no doubt saw the new home sales yesterday, completely reversing Wall Street's best estimates and heading down. It was the third decline in as many months. So the question we have to ask is real estate headed off in a different direction once again? Is real estate becoming soft? Well, in just a few minutes, that ubiquitous Case-Shiller Index will be released, and we'll get to see once again how the real estate markets looked. At 2 p.m. Eastern Time this afternoon, the Federal Open Market Committee will once again announce their decision on interest rates. Now, the committee meets 8 times a year, and they are responsible for setting the short-term rates for banks and financial institutions around the country. It's a weighty decision, to be sure, because it can set the general monetary conditions throughout the financial system. Once again, Wall Street has decided that the FOMC will keep rates right where they are at essentially 0.25%. But how can that be? With inflation running at over 5% by some measures, shouldn't the Fed raise rates here to help curtail inflation? It's the most asked questions that I get right now. How can the Fed just stand by and let inflation run? Now, the Fed's own published explanation is that the current inflation rate is just temporary, that it's due primarily to the supply chain and other short-term effects, which should work their way out shortly. But somehow that's an unsatisfying answer. There has to be more to this story than just ignoring a temporary blip in prices. And there is. It's a story that goes back to 1987 and the actions of a newly installed chairman of the Fed, Alan Greenspan. Now, Greenspan had been chairman of the Fed for only a few months when the great crash of 1987 literally brought Wall Street to its knees. At the time, I was working at a large West Coast firm, and a clerk came running up to me, asking me to go down to trading. Something was happening, the phones were ringing off the hook, and they needed all the people they could get to take trades. Over the next few days, I saw firsthand a market getting completely unhinged. And it was against this background that Alan Greenspan, along with the U.S. Treasury Department, the SEC, and literally all the capability of the federal government, came to help bring the markets back to normal. It was during this time that Greenspan proposed the innovative monetary strategies that we now lump into the term quantitative easing, the concept of providing unlimited amounts of liquidity to stave off a financial crisis. Now, best of all, these strategies worked. Markets regained their equilibrium and began to rally. And in fact, the markets had the fastest recovery ever. For many today, the crash of 87 is just a blip on the financial progress of this nation. But for Wall Street, it had found its champion. Alan Greenspan had brought us back from the abyss. And the Greenspan put was born. The feeling on the street that we needn't worry, Alan Greenspan had our backs. And no matter how out of whack things might seem, Greenspan would right the ship. What this did essentially was put another responsibility on the back of the Fed, a responsibility that continues until today. You may have heard that the Fed has the twin mandate of providing stable prices and full employment. Well, since Alan Greenspan, you can add another mandate, keeping financial markets moving in the right direction. And it is this third, unspoken mandate, this market support, which is the real reason that the Fed is unlikely to change interest rates today. Yes, inflation is heating up, but if the Fed raises rates, markets would likely fall. And in the post-Greenspan Fed, we can't have that. Well, as we close out the first half of 2021, it is becoming clear what an utter shambles our international trade policy is in. This year will most likely be the first year in history that the U.S. trade deficit surpasses $1 trillion, a sign that our economy continues to be in real trouble. Let me put this another way. This year, the USA will send $1 trillion to its trading partners, read predatory sellers around the globe. In another era, this was referred to as beggar thy neighbor. Only it's America that's rapidly becoming the beggar. We're like a shopper who can't help themselves. They stay at home, hooked up to Amazon or QVC or the latest shopping network. They buy every supposed bargain that comes along. But pretty soon, they have a house full of worthless goods and an empty wallet. It's the way that the imperial powers of the 16th through the 19th century treated their colonies. They extracted the wealth from the colonies, usually in the form of raw materials, precious metals, and minerals, and sent back their manufactured items, usually at highly inflated prices. There's an extreme irony here in that the most sophisticated nation on earth now sends its wealth overseas to its trading partners, who in return send us their often cheaply made retail items at inflated prices. U.S. dollars flow one way, inexpensive manufactured items come the other. And just like those colonies of long ago, one side grows wealthy while the other is impoverished. Here's what we've found out lately about our trade deficit. 7 times the U.S. trade deficit has exceeded $85 billion in a single month. 6 of those 7 months have been this year. 2x the trade deficit has exceeded $90 billion in a month. That was in March of this year, and yesterday it was reported that in June we also exceeded the $90 billion level. Only once have we had a year in which our trade balance reached $750 million. And as I say, this year it's a shoe-in to reach the $1 trillion level. We're already more than halfway there. There are some important changes in our trading picture, however, that we should talk about. First, China is no longer our number one trading partner. That much maligned USMCA trade agreement with Mexico and China, passed in late 2018, has moved both Canada and Mexico ahead of China. This has helped mitigate the predatory practices of China by overall reducing their role. Second, although our deficit with China is the single largest of any country, still, China represents only about 1/4 of our trade deficit. So don't think that the Europeans or other Asian countries and nations around the world aren't also taking advantage of the U.S. Now, in just a few minutes, we'll get our first look at the second quarter's gross domestic product. Analysts expect this to be an outstanding growth report, showing total economic growth somewhere north of 8%. But just imagine what growth we could have achieved if we would just buy American.
Well, yesterday it was reported that the United States total economy, the gross domestic product, grew at 6.5% for the second quarter. When calculated out on an annual basis, this means that this year, the American economy will produce over $22 trillion in goods and services, an all-time record, and beating our 2019 record by over $600 billion. Just think of it. In spite of all the trials and tribulations of the past year, still Americans' workers and management have been able to exceed their best ever production by $600 billion. Now, to put that in perspective, just that change, that $600 billion, would rank as the 22nd largest economy in the world and would be greater than the total economies produced in countries like Sweden, Poland, and Belgium. And that's just the USA's delta, the amount our economy grew over its best ever year before. Now, you would think that Wall Street would be ecstatic, that the champagne would be flowing, that politicians around the country would be running to the nearest TV camera to shout out the news. But if anything at all, just the opposite is happening. The financial world is somewhat glum, and all the talking heads are bemoaning how yesterday's report missed expectations. You see, all of these numbers, no matter how encouraging, happened a month ago. It was over at the end of June. Markets are always focused on what's ahead, and it's our immediate future that's beginning to look a little questionable. As we climb out of the devastation of the economy after last year's economic lockdowns, when things were looking brighter. By every measure, it appears that this economy was set to begin a growth period, which should, by any past measures, be expected to last for many months, if not years. The stock market is roaring, hitting new highs nearly every week, and the two models of the Federal Reserve were predicting growth of somewhere between 8 and 10% for the foreseeable future. But that's gone now. Just the day before that we got this latest reading on the GDP, the Federal Reserve Open Market Committee was wrapping up their two-day meeting. And as they do every meeting, the Fed was taking a survey of how all the members felt the economy was currently looking. Now, if there's anyone who is in tune with our current financial picture, these people are the ones. They have the most sophisticated econometric models, the latest industry surveys, all to give them the best estimates of what lie ahead. So what do you think they're seeing right now? Perhaps a near double-digit growth, which the Atlanta Fed saw last year? No, not even close. Well, okay, how about the extended growth level that we just reported? Perhaps around that 6% growth level. But again, no, that's not even close either. In that survey of the FOMC members just completed the day before yesterday, they're now seeing growth, if you call it that, of just 2.4% in 2023, and that's only 18 months from now. Unless something changes between now and the year after next, we'll be back in a situation where we are struggling economically. And that's why Wall Street is so glum. And that's also why you can hold off on that bubbly, at least until this economy gains some more momentum. And that's Value Side USA for the weekend of July 31. I'm your host, David Revelle. Please join me in praying that our country may get back to work.